Thanks, Dave.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, Justice involved. I'm Jonathan Benson, representing the North Thomas here today. This court back in 2007, the Alston case, took a pretty extensive and exhaustive look at post-release supervision, jury sentencing, the limits to it, what extensions could occur. This court got it right. They got it right. And not once in that Alston decision was the term incarceration used, that is, post-release incarceration, suspended incarceration. The statute, 219.2, 295.2, does not use the word incarceration. In the right circumstances, and Amanda Thomas's sentencing event was the right circumstance, there was no suspended portion to her sentence, the trial judge shall impose a period, a suspended period of post-release supervision. That's exactly the language of the statute, exactly the language as worked out in your Alston decision, and remands the matter further to the parole board. The case never comes back to the trial court. Goes to the parole board to follow their rules and proceedings, and if there's a violation of the plan of post-release supervision prepared by the parole board, then there will be parole board hearings that can lead, under the terms of the statute, to a recommitment. The term incarceration does not show up. The mischief maker, the outlier here, I submit to the court, is the 1997 case of Allard versus Commonwealth comes out of the Court of Appeals. The decision, or the actual case, came up with no objection at the trial level, so there was procedural default on the appeal level. That was, ends of justice was not met. And then the court dives off into a thicket of dicta, no proper case before it on this issue, and introduces for the first and only time I can determine the term suspended incarceration. Goes on to use the unfortunate language that now the verdict of a jury is no longer the minimum or the maximum term of incarceration. And I'm afraid that's what got Judge Giesler, and bless his heart, I love him to death, he walked all over this situation. He made a mess.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions, if
sure.
You don't mind. This is something that I've watched legislatively as the General Assembly of Virginia has fiddled with it. They didn't correct it during the last session. There was an effort to do it, and frankly, they just got tired of each other and they packed their bags and went home.
Well, there was some of that.
Yeah. If let's just use a hypothetical. If attempted robbery carries 2 to 10, it does. The jury can give you 10. The jury can't give you 11 because it's 2 to 10. Whether the court can, at sentencing, add 3 is a question that probably, more than probably, implicates the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution. But if it's a trial judge that has the whole case and there's no jury at all, arguably the Commonwealth, the legislature, can say, yeah, it's 2 to 10 under 18.2-10. But every case is subject to this statute that can add 3 years of additional incarceration, because we, the legislature, can do that and add it to 18.10. Now, your case is a jury case.
That's right.
But there is no argument here about the constitutional question.
That's exactly right.
Well, it seems to me, given that, haven't we missed an opportunity to invoke the due process problems with the jury issue rather than a judge issue?
The way I looked at it, Your Honor, is the order that was entered here was so defective, that is, by imposing a 10-year sentence, suspending 3 years on active probation under the supervision of that court, just totally left.
Well, you might be right about that. You may have a straight statutory question that even when a judge does it, they can't do it this way.
That's right. And that really is my argument.
I understand that. I just think there may very well be a compelling argument that with a jury trial, there's another reason why you can't do it.
Actually, I thought the Alston decision really worked on that point and talked about the maximum sentence in a jury trial and what could be added to it under the statute, because it's not denominated as an additional sentence. There's no additional facts being found by the judge. He is ordered by the statute to impose a period of post-release supervision of a range, and uses his discretion to go between 6 months and 3 years. And so I think there is an issue as to what that judge's discretion, maybe that could become a constitutional issue in the imposition of this additional sentence. But when we have a sentencing event that is as defective as this one was, my decision was to come up to the appellate court level and say, let's at least get a sentence that complies with the code section, and if necessary, appeal it back up again with it properly positioned.
There are trial judges across the Commonwealth that have figured out their own fixes for this. And we find that out at judicial conferences and things of that nature. For example, if in my hypothetical attempted robberies 2 to 10, the jury gives them 10, that statute is out there with another 3, there are judges that have said, well, the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to suspend 3 of the sentence that the trial that the jury has given. Therefore, there's still 3 years active from the jury, which is lawful.
And that removes you from the statute when you do that.
That's right.
Because there's a suspended period of active probation.
Is there any impediment to the court using its contempt powers to enforce?
I don't think so. That goes to the question of what is actually the punishment.
I've told you, abide by these conditions of probation, report to your probation officer, look for a job, abstain from drugs. Well, we then do one or all of those things. So you've disobeyed an order of the court, same in domestic relations, pay your spouse support, you didn't do that, contempt, whatever. Isn't that the enforcement mechanism? Or a possible enforcement mechanism?
Two responses. One, this is the old parole system. With all the mechanisms involved, it was a recognition that on release a person needed to have some supervision. It's a good idea. But when people come out of jail on a 10-year sentence, they'll typically have served 8.5 years, roughly, and have what's called comeback time. And that sets up the old classic parole violation setup, where the first teeth, if you will, is if they violate post-release supervision, they can be made to go back and do all that good time that they got out early on. That's the old classic parole arrangement. The other part is what you just mentioned, is the contempt power of the court. That's not very big teeth, but it is teeth. The defendant has not complied with a circuit court order. Where it's most stark on that, and this has just happened to me, a person found guilty of possession of a firearm is a violent felon, where the minimum, maximum, and mandatory are all 5 years. He'll do day for day for 5 years, have no comeback time, and the court imposed a 6-month post-release supervision. The statute, and that particular judge, Judge Harrell, followed it, the letter of that statute, which I submit to the court is the only way under the current array that you can make this comply with your Alston decision, is use the language of the statute. Impose a period of suspended post-release supervision answerable to the parole board, and but reference the code section. And then that's what Judge Harrell and several of our other judges are now doing. There's been a problem in our circuit. We had about 3 different approaches, and we're down to 2.
But we do have the court's office of executive secretary has written out the code provision precisely in a recommended form order, exactly as you suggested it would be.
Yes.
It's not that complicated.
Unfortunately, the wrong order was used, I think.
Now, but let me ask you this. Let's go back to the perfect world. Suppose it had been done correctly, which is 3 years, you got 3 years. 3 years tacked on by statute, sent to the parole board. The parole board finds, let's say hypothetically, he gets out of the 7 years, or 6.5, or 5.75. He goes into the 3 years, he violates the terms of the parole board condition. The statute says he's recommitted.
Yes.
Well, doesn't the 3 years necessarily imply in the statute that the term of recommitment is up to 3 years?
And I think it does.
So it sort of makes a lot of sense in a way. The 3 years is literally carved out of the judicial system. We're not concerned with the 3 years anymore. We have nothing to do with it. We just impose it because we're told to impose it. and the parole board does whatever it does, however it wants to do it, and has the power to put him back into a penitentiary, because that's what, I guess, recommitment means, up to 3 years in this instance.
And under Alston, the saving grace is that the judge does not make any additional fact-finding before he imposes that. He follows the statute. Whether there's a larger question as to whether there's due process violation here, I think is a legitimate question. I don't think this case formed it up correctly.
Yeah, well, I mean, on that subject, the legislature can always tack on a non-discretionary enhancement for any reason. That doesn't require, under the Apprendi doctrine, the decision of the jury on predicate facts for the enhancement. So if it was a mandatory 3 years no matter what, and this, no matter what the jury does, that's fine. If it's a mandatory 3 years like the old federal sentencing guidelines, but you got to make a bunch of fact-finding, then it's not good. The jury has to decide that. So my only question is, assuming everything you say is right about the flawed nature of the way the order is drafted, it was wrong to say 10 minus 7. It was wrong to do it to keep control over the case. All that's just wrong statutorily. Is it really, did the judge intend to do that, or was it just poor draftsmanship? Maybe, you know, the clerk of courts worked these forms up for the judges in some cases. Should we just send it back and say, consider whether, maybe it's not a clerical error, maybe you meant to do this, but consider whether it is.
It should be sent back. What I would like to see is this court just clarify exactly what the language or the procedure for imposing this post-release supervision period is. So there's apparently there are draft forms. The Commonwealth has argued in their response that the judge discussed the code section from the bench, but I've been on the receiving end many times of the rule that a court speaks by its orders, not by its musings from the bench. And the other thing that they rely on, point out, is the report on the sentencing guidelines, where the judge indicates the imposed 10 years, 3 years suspended. He calls it post-relief, checks that block, but he also checks active probation. And down at the bottom of the page, he lists the enhancement reasons, the serious injury to the child,
his problem,
all the
of course,
things that would foul you out on Apprendi.
His problem is he started off with 10. The 10's
basically
not the starting
point
in any of this.
He did an explanation for an upward deviation, like he was going above the guidelines instead of going above a jury verdict. It's just wrong.
I'm sorry. When you're finished. On 90, JA-90, the court appears to have done what I think the code allows it to do. I guess this is the executive secretary's form, JA-9, where it adds the 3 years of post-release term under 18-210, and then it suspends it under 295-2A. Are you saying that that is inappropriate, that that's not the way it should be done?
The way it should be done is that the judge would impose a seven-year jury sentence, assuming he's not suspending any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, pursuant to 19.2 to 295.2, the court imposes an additional term of post-release supervision.
Okay.
Just track the language of the statute.
What about 18.210, where it says he will also add 3 years of suspended incarceration?
That's not how I remember 210. 18.2-10 is using additional incarceration. They reference 295.2, is my record.
295.2 is the supervision, the post-release supervision. But as I understand how this works, you couple 295.2 with 18.2.10. 18.2.10 says for any felony offense after 1995 and 2000 shall, except in cases in which the court orders a suspended term of confinement of less than 6 months, impose an additional term of not less than 6 months nor more than 3 years.
Yes.
And then it references 295.2.
And it says, which shall be suspended conditional on successful completion. There's no, the word incarceration only shows up in that Allard case. Directly equating 295.2 with incarceration as opposed to post-release supervision.
So, I wonder though. I'm sorry.
So your argument that term in 18.210 is the same as the suspended time in 295.2? That's your argument?
Yes, because it's a suspended. It is 6 months to 3 years suspended condition on successful completion of 295.2 terms.
Okay, let me try this. 18 and perhaps on 18 to 10 references a term of confinement when it talks about the when this shall take place, except in cases in when a court orders a suspended term of confinement. Then it goes on to say impose an additional term. I read that term to refer back to term of confinement, so that the two things are both referring to a term of confinement.
You are in a position to read it that way if you choose. I mean, it's not clear.
Well, nobody talks about a term of supervision. That's just not how we talk about it. Talk about a term of confinement, but not supervision. But your argument is a very good one. I'm not criticizing your argument. I think it's very, very difficult. And the only thing that what bothers me about this is I'm concerned that the statute as it's written wasn't followed. But the statute as it's written has so many problems with it. But I can't get to those things in your case.
I agree with both statements. Mm-hmm. Because I think first we have to have a proper... a sentence that's proper under the statute before we can look legitimately at the statute. Maybe I made the wrong decision on that. Alston had the Apprendi issues fully briefed before. It was well done. And this court threaded that needle very carefully. Maybe it needs to be revisited. I didn't think coming forward with a 10-year sentence on a 7-year jury verdict and 3 years of active probation was a way to get into that structure of that sentencing, that post-release supervision, because it was such a mess.
Your argument, it wasn't really post-release supervision.
It's active probation. He added 3 years on top of a jury verdict and gave her active probation. That's what the sentencing order says. Now, there could be Scrivener's error, but his report on the guidelines seems to back up that he was doing exactly that. So...
all right, well, your time has expired. Let's see what Ms. Fitzgerald has to say.
Well, thank you for that.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald, on behalf of the Commonwealth. I think it's important to remember in this case, the issue before this court is whether the trial court erred in imposing additional suspended time.
It's not quite that simple, though, because he is supposed to impose, in fact, additional suspended time, but he has no power, the trial judge has no power to administer it, to enter any orders based upon it, and it's not part of the jury verdict that he is empowered or she is empowered to process. So it's the parole board's job. So isn't that exactly the problem here? You don't start off and say seven. I'm going to add three to it. Now I got 10. Now I'm going to take three away. Now I got 7 of active, and I the trial judge, will administer the 3 suspended. You say 7. The jury gave it to you. You're gone. I'm not going to do anything. 3. The parole board takes over and does whatever it wants to do, including put him in prison for 3 years, recommitted if he screws up the term of supervision. So it's not a clerical error. It's a flawed understanding of the statute.
Your Honor, I would refer the court to assignment of error in this case and also to the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, which solely addressed the issue of whether the trial judge had statutory authorization to impose that extra 3-year sentence, which it does under 18.210G. I agree with Justice Powell's analysis of that code section. It talks of the term of confinement, and the trial court shall impose that additional term of confinement. Whether we go 7 plus 3 equals 10 or 10 minus 3 equals 7, there is no additional active time being imposed there except the suspended
I'm agreeing with you, too, on that point, logically. But the parole board is the entity that decides whether to impose that 3 years. You're right. The judiciary has to put the 3 years on it.
And I think for that reason, Your Honor, the Commonwealth prevails in this appeal because that is the narrow issue before the court. Whether the trial court was statutorily authorized to impose an additional suspension.
The dilemma is you could interpret it as the parole board's opportunity to deal with the gap in the statute. They get to deal with it. But you could also interpret it as that the legislature has actually decreed that there's another 3 years of potential incarceration for failure to follow the supervisory responsibilities that's added on to 18.2 sentencing. So you got 10 years in my hypothetical plus 3. That works for every case except a jury.
Your Honor, I believe it would also work in the case of a jury case where there the court is limited under 19.2295, as the defendant points out here. The jury, the maximum there, plus the statutory period of post-supervision release, which is secured by a period of a suspended term of incarceration under 18.210. Those code sections work in conjunction with each other. The max active
well,
time...
Well, I get that. I understand it. But in one case, I don't think it even raises constitutional questions. That's when the judge is making the decision. In the other, when a jury makes a decision, there's an overlay of constitutional questions that make it suspect. That's all I'm saying. So I think the statute may very well say exactly what you just said. It's just that it can't constitutionally say it when the jury has made the verdict as opposed to the judge.
And I would note that the Alston case was a jury verdict when this court addressed the issue of under Apprendi, and that was the Sixth Amendment context, not due process, and there's
right.
a little bit of a difference there. But that was a jury verdict in that case, and I would submit that this court has addressed that issue, and in any event, it's not squarely raised.
Have we addressed, I mean, I know we often say the state constitutional provisions are coextensive with the federal, not without good reason, but have we analyzed the outer boundary of the state constitutional requirement of jury trial? And also a related issue of separation of powers, which is a parole board is an executive branch agency, and ordinarily, you know, disposition of criminal questions like, you know, revoking somebody, decisions made by a judge. I mean, is there a potential for separation of powers problem to entrust to the executive branch this kind of decision making as opposed to the judicial branch?
I will try to answer that question as best I can. I will say, Your Honor, I don't think this has been briefed by the parties. It wasn't raised by
no,
the defendant.
And
it's not encompassed in the assignment of error. But to your point, 19.2295(2) sub D says nothing in this section shall be construed to prohibit the court from exercising any authority otherwise granted by law. So under 19, so you look at that, otherwise other authority, you know, granted by law, the courts do have jurisdiction over suspended sentence, any suspended sentence issued by the court under 19.2306. So if that suspended sentence is imposed by the judge under 18.2 sub G, where the court orders a suspended term of confinement, the court still does retain some authority over that under 19.2306, which is recognized.
But not the imposed incarceration over the jury fixed term, right? A trial judge doesn't have the authority to add.
Correct. Not on the term
okay,
fixed by the jury, only on the 3 years of suspended time imposed.
Right. So how do you get to suspending 3 years without adding 3 years if you're not going through the proper statute, which is not a judicially administered? It's a piece of the old parole system. Obviously, the parole system is constitutional. It's just a remnant of that. So, in other words, if a trial judge can't tack on 3 years to a 7-year jury sentence, period, it likewise can't tack it on and suspend it and then put his or her probation officer in charge of administering that and then 3 years later decide whether to put him back into prison for 3 years.
Respectfully, I would say under the statutory scheme, it seems like you can.
You can?
And in fact, you have to. The trial court shall order this term of suspension.
But the trial judge doesn't administer any of it. The parole board administers it, and the parole board, there's no probation violation hearing. Tell me if I'm right or wrong on this. Under 19.2, 295.2 in a court.
Well, I think that there could be, Your Honor, because under sub D, the trial court would have the ability to take that person back. However, this post-release under sub C is operated through probation and parole districts. So you're looking at the same probation officer under either set of circumstances would be dealing with this person. They would have the same terms there, and whether they're ultimately responsible to the trial court or the parole board, they have that same 3 years, the same teeth hanging over
their head. So you think that D authorizes the trial court to say, look, I don't trust the parole board. I'm going to decide whether the 3 years gets violated and how much of the 3 years to give back. Would he have the authority to do that?
argue that you would, Your Honor, because the code section specifically reserves to the trial court.
Otherwise granted by law. Where's the otherwise?
Otherwise granted by law. So it's a suspended sentence imposed under 18210. And under 19-2306, the trial judge has jurisdiction to look at probation and resentencing for any suspended sentence. It's a suspended sentence issued by the court. It could come back to the court.
You don't have the authority to suspend a sentence without having authority to impose a sentence.
I believe the court does have authority to impose that sentence under 18-210G, and in fact is obligated to impose that sentence by statute under the current statutory scheme as it exists, which is what this trial court was working with.
Well, he doesn't raise a constitutional question, but if he did, why isn't what you just said constitutionally infirm? Because there's a jury verdict. Now, obviously, he might not have served it all. So the real question is, he got sentenced to 10, let's say 10. He got out in 8. Okay, we got 2, right? But he really was sentenced to 7. Suppose he is sentenced to 7 by the jury, which is what happened here. He only served 5. Mm-hmm. We got 2. That's
served
within that
years,
sentence.
Your Honor, because he good time credits, or because the judge suspended them, or
whatever. He still hasn't served 2 years of the sentence of the jury.
Okay.
Right. That gives you some room. But it seems to me that under no circumstances can there ever be more than 7 years of incarceration by whatever means you get to it after a jury said that's his sentence without having constitutional questions associated with it. Now, I actually think that it might work if it's just a judge determination. It makes it for a very awkward statute, but I think it might work without constitutional problems. But when a jury says 7, it's 7. It's not 10. Let's tack on 3 more. It's 7.
And I think that's the Apprendi problem, Your Honor, that this court has already resolved in Alston. And I would note, I think it's Williams also, which was a guilty plea case, where the parties agreed to a specific sentence. And this court said, no, you also get that post-supervision release afterwards because that is the law of the Commonwealth. So whether you agree to the sentence in a guilty plea context, whether you're sentenced to it by a jury, or whether you get it from a bench trial, this statutory additional period comes on top. It's part of the statutory maximum, and also as part of the constitutional one, as this court decided in Alston under Apprendi.
But I mean, it's not an Apprendi problem because there's no fact-finding. As you point out, it's automatic.
Yes.
I mean, you know, depending on what's not automatic in the sense of if there's already suspended time, but the point is, I mean, its application is clear. It's just we're struggling with the, you know, these elephants in the room of, and the related canon of statutory construction of avoiding constitutional, or at least potential constitutional problems. So you have a statute that's a bit of a dog's breakfast, and you have this constitutional overlay that's not briefed, and that we're not even necessarily sure what the answer is. It just makes it tough. That's why we're asking for your help.
Yeah, I think it is a difficult code section,
but I'm not sure.
This might be a cop out, but I don't know if this case is the vehicle to get where the court is trying to go.
Well, you're probably right about that. It's probably not the vehicle, but sometimes when you're not asking these questions, when you actually resolve the case that you do have in front of you, you regret some of the things you said. And I think that's why you're getting all of these questions about things that are not really in front of us in this case.
That's right.
I'm concerned, too, that maybe in the dialogue with the chief, you may not be hearing as much as what I think he's saying. There are two paradigms here. There is a jury comes up with 7 and question, can a judge, after jury has said 7 under Virginia law, tack on 3 and then suspend 3 and then administer it with his probation officers? I think the answer to that, you may disagree, is clearly no, for all the reasons the chief said. There's no doubt, as we've held, that there's no Apprendi violation and there's no violation of due process, which is nothing but an Apprendi-light analysis. If the legislature says, no matter what a jury does and no matter what a bench trial does, we're always going to tack on 2 for this or that or the other crime, so long as there's no fact-finding required beyond a reasonable doubt. So far, so good. What we have here and what the appellant's argument here is, we have a statute that clearly does tack on 3 years to 5 years. It is not contingent upon any Apprendi fact-finding. It's not relevant. Burden of proofs are not relevant. beyond reasonable doubt is not relevant, is always tacked on. But it's not tacked on for the judge. It's tacked on for a completely different entity, the parole board. And this order doesn't say that or do that. He tacks it on for him. He puts 10 on him, does 3 suspended, and then administers the 3 with his parole officer, not the parole board. Why isn't that just wrong? Why shouldn't we just say that's just not the way it works? You need to say 7 plus 3 minus 3, and the 3 never comes back to you. You have nothing to do with the 3.
I mean, to the extent that we're talking about a difference in nomenclature, if the court feels that it would be more clear for this to be written in a different way, and I agree that it's not written the way we normally see these, the remedy would be remand to fix that, which I submit would be a clerical error, because the other thing that we have to notice here is that this judgment comes to us with a presumption of regularity that the trial judge knew and followed the law. In addition to that presumption, we have a record here which establishes the trial judge was aware of this code section, says on appendix page 58 that I am imposing and suspending this time under 19.2295.2, and then goes on and lists in the guidelines worksheet, which is appended to the order, that he is suspending this time under that code section.
So really, all that really needs to happen from that perspective is he takes the OES form and replaces it with the language here, and game over, right?
The point of that narrative was that there's no requirement in the code section that it be mentioned by name in the final order. There's no magic words that need to be imposed for this to happen the way it happens under the code section. Given that here we have the trial judge who intended to impose it this way, who we presume was knowing and following the law, and to the extent that there's a verbal difference there, I would argue that it could be a distinction of a difference. I understand from the probation versus parole that I think we might disagree on that point. But to the extent that the court disagrees with me and finds that difference is significant, and that the judge was required to put that code section in to accomplish this purpose, then I would agree that it's a clerical error and it should be remanded to fix that clerical error. But the issue before the court regarding the ability to spend that time, not only was the court able, but the court was required under this existing statutory scheme. And I know you are aware we have a small record, and many of these issues are not only in the record trial, not in the record on appeal, and weren't addressed by the Court of Appeals below. So to the extent that the court wishes supplemental briefing on any of those constitutional issues, I'd be happy to comply, but
thanks to both of you for helping us work through all of these things, even if they're not in front of us today. And the one thing that's also not in front of us today is we can't remand this to the legislature, which is probably where it needs to go.
Yes, and I'm aware, Your Honor, that there was also that amendment. It seemed that it came very close to passing this term, but fell out. So hopefully we might see some changes in this direction sooner.
Well, thanks to both of you for your arguments. We appreciate it. Call the next case.